in this Congress to address the experiences in or of business ventures across the borders, and particularly, of course, in the Asian region. The concepts to be examined will include a number of aspects, and perhaps I could just briefly talk to you about some of these aspects. First, communications. Now, as you will know, this is always at the heart of doing business in another country. It involves the technical facilities, the problems associated with cultural and ethnic differences. Number two, the problems and solutions relating to different personal perspectives and contracts and even contractual law. I once heard a very good description of a long-term contract by a senior Japanese businessman. He likened it to a small child. He said it needs love, affection and attention in its infancy. And when it becomes a teenager, of course, the circumstances change. And when it becomes an adult, there is another change. Now, the impact of these changes needs to be recognised by the parties to the contract. And this is just one example. And I feel sure that my friend John Ralph, in his role as a miner and an exporter, will acknowledge that unless there are benefits to both parties to a contract, no matter what may be written, then the relationship will ultimately fail to the detriment of both of the parties. Number three on our agenda, an analysis of different systems of reward and the propriety of a fair payment for risk and effort. And we remember that His Eminence the Cardinal told us this morning of the obligations of business, not only in the development of human skills, but in ensuring that those skills are amply rewarded. Number four, a discussion of efforts by business partners to understand, to interpret, and to advise on government policies for the development of business ventures. Number five, an analysis of efforts to create a shared understanding of different financial accounting and auditing practices in diverse economies and cultures. Number six, a review of practices relating to the selection, the recruitment and the employment of workers and management. And there was some discussion about that this morning. Number seven, human resource development programs. And finally, cultural differences and their impact on marketing programs. Now, as Barry Council mentioned to you before lunch, there will be three segments in this part of the Congress, with two speakers in each segment, one speaker from Asia and one speaker from Australia. And the industry groupings we have selected are finance and banking, number one, number two, footwear and textiles, number three, food and milk products. The six individual speeches will be followed by an open forum during which all speakers will be here on the stage to answer questions and even debate some of the issues that you may raise. Now, ladies and gentlemen, our first speaker this afternoon is Will Bailey, who is the Group Chief Executive of the ANZ Banking Group. With the bank since 1950, a number of senior appointments abroad, including London, currently also Deputy Chairman of Grindley's Bank, which, as most of you will know, has wide and diverse international interests. Outside the bank, Will Bailey, like most bankers, is very active. He's a director of Dalgetty Farmers Limited. He's the president of the Australian Institute of Bankers. He holds a very important chairmanship, the Economics Committee of the Business Council of Australia. And the Business Council of Australia is an organisation which represents broadly the top 80 to 90 companies in Australia. He's chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Centre of Independent Studies, which is a think tank. He's chairman of the Governing Board of the University of Melbourne Graduate School of Management Foundation. probably one of his most important outside responsibilities is that he's a member of the government's Economic Planning and Advisory Council. And I can assure you that as one of his colleagues, I have a lot of sympathy with him, because that's a very demanding office and a very difficult one. He was also associated with some charity or community service organisations like the Baker Medical Research Institute, the Australian Opera, and in his spare time he runs the ANZ Bank. Now, as one of Australia's, as a banker, I suppose, I have a great deal of difficulty, or perhaps even some reluctance, in introducing him as Australia's leading banker, but I can certainly introduce him as one of Australia's leading bankers. So over to you, Will.
Thank you, Mr. Robert White. It's always nice to be introduced by a competitor, particularly one who, while still active, has somewhat officially retired. It's always a delight, too, to be the first speaker after lunch. And perhaps I should give my final words first, so that then if you wish to sleep through, at least you'll know what I've finished on. It would be very easy for me as a banker to talk in some depth about banking problems that are facing this particular area, but with an open forum, I've no doubt those present that want to raise those issues will do so. I thought I'd try and talk about the human face of banking in this particular region. The human face is common to all people of all races. Yet, each person, no matter what creed they have, what race they come from, has an individual face. It's our face by which we are known, just as we recognise other people by our faces. The human face records our life story. It reveals our hopes and our aspirations, and it gives away our fears. In short, nothing in the world says more about us personally than our face. Banks, of course, are not human beings, so they can't literally have a human face like yours or mine. Of course, banks, like other institutions and enterprises, do have a public image. Our particular group devotes a considerable amount of time and money and the talents of many capable people to creating and maintaining a face which is acceptable to our many publics in the countries in which we are represented. Our competitors, whose headquarters may lie outside the Asian region, are equally concerned with their image or their face. These, of course, are not simply public relations exercises or the application of manipulative techniques by advertisers or by our own marketers. Why? Simply because behind the organisation and sustaining the structure of the enterprise itself are many, many individual human beings. Remove them and the enterprise ceases to exist. They are the real face, the human face of an organisation. And of course, banking in this regard is no different to the organisations to which you belong, be they business, be they charitable, be they community, be they government. Each of us belongs to an organisation, some merely a family, which has a name, a legal and economic identity, and which does control some finite resources. That organisation might seem at times to act independently of the people, yet in the last analysis it really only behaves in the way you decide. It is only the sum of the actions of people that make it up. The way people act is the way the organisation itself ultimately acts. This is even the case with an organisation's history, because history, of course, is the accumulation of the past deeds of individuals. The key to successful organisation is successful people, particularly the quality of individuals and their relationships with each other. I want to focus now on the quality of the relationships between people and to give you an insight into its importance in banking in the Asian region. I believe there are parallels for other industries and also for government. Let me say now that I see development as the major goal of economic activity in this region. And this, of course, even applies to the most successful countries like Japan. The Asian region is part of the international economy. We all know this. Indeed, even some Australians who have been reluctant to grasp this fact have suddenly woken up to it now. Much has been said about the dynamic growth of our region, and many have argued that the engines of the world's economy in the future will centre on this particular part of the world. And even if they're right, it doesn't allow us to rest. In fact, it must urge us all to redouble our efforts. The world simply doesn't sleep. It's awake somewhere, sometime. The level of economic output across some 150 countries continues to rise. None of us can afford a pause. We just can't settle back and enjoy our current levels of achievement. Because if we do, if we stop, someone will take the opportunity to pass us. And if a country could realise that in this sense, it's Australia and it's New Zealand. Countries that did sit on their oars, that allowed the ship to lose its way and are now trying to catch up rather quickly. But it takes a lot more effort to catch the field than to stay with it or be in front. And of course, this is equally true for developed countries, less developed countries, and of course, newly industrialised countries. The categorisation of countries continues to increase to try and define success. In all of this, people, of course, are the key. The way we manage the human face of development will be the ultimate test. In our banking experience of my enterprise, where we operate in 40-odd countries, and particularly in the Asian regions, it does parallels the development of economic growth. I can assure you that in every country, the calibre of our people is the best guide to our success. In this program we have on the agenda today and tomorrow, the program mentions challenges, problems, opportunities. So let me, in developing a few of these thoughts, look at things under those headings, challenges. The challenge for banking in the region is to build a network that works. What is a network? Well, there are many types, and I suppose the basic and the oldest network was face-to-face dialogue, which is really sharing information with another person. The grapevine, that term we use to describe a long chain of people passing and receiving information, is another. At the other extreme of the march of information technology has made it possible to have huge global networks for passing and receiving all manner of information. This network is still a network, even though it's far more highly advanced. Bankers are particularly good and efficient at moving information from one place to another. After all, capital is a specialised form of information, and moving it prudently is a banker's skill. Capital flows throughout the international economy today are huge, some 25 times greater than the total value of world trade in goods and services. Foreign exchange transactions are information flows too, and the value of these flows far exceed the value of worldwide trade in goods and services. The network principles behind these large, complex information networks are no different to those in face-to-face relationships or in grapevine-type networks. They are all dependent on communications. For banking, the importance of communications is indeed high. Networks provide the channels that serve to add value by managing these and many other information flows. The network may be made up of many computers, or of a telephone, or of a telex challenge, or fax. It could be based on mail or on personal relationships. In fact, our networks are based on all of these, plus many more. Each serves to add value directly or indirectly to our customers, and they do this by letting us communicate. Let me give you an example. We have corporate relationships with many large Korean groups. We also have the largest foreign bank in the Indian subcontinent. Both countries and the enterprises with whom we have relationships benefit from our network because it allows them to communicate and to move information which added value to all parties. In one case, the Hyundai Corporation of Korea was able to successfully bid through an international consortium for a large construction in Bombay in India. At the same time, we were actively using the network in our role as a banker to Mitsui of Japan on stage one of the same port contract in Bombay. This is a case where there were different countries and people networking for a common benefit. There were Koreans, there were Japanese, there were Australians, and there were Koreans, all working, networking, understanding one another, and working for a common purpose. There are many other examples, but I think that one illustrates my point well enough. Networks allow us to communicate and to add value by linking countries, governments, and enterprises together. For us as bankers, that's a great challenge. But remember, the real communications of the banking networks that cross national borders are communications between people. The human face making contact with another human face. The technologies in between are important, of course they are, but they must be managed, but they must always serve as communications. Our challenge is to build systems that support people, that allow them to be productive and to communicate with others. These people, of course, are customers, they're our staff, they're intermediaries, they're governments, regulators, suppliers, and many, many others. They have different languages, religions, countries, and cultures. Yet they are able to produce value and raise productivity in a region through means of communication through international networks. That is a major challenge. That was a major challenge and is between bankers, and I believe for one of the whole region. From the challenge of communications, let me now turn to problems, or at least a representative problem. In my opinion, unless there are proposed solutions, there is little point of adding to the list of problems. Anyone can add to an already long list. The point is to set some priority for action. One priority is to broaden staff and customer awareness of the opportunities of a region. In an international market, awareness of the needs of clients in other countries and the capacity of the organisation to meet them is vital. How else can Korean or Japanese enterprises begin to deal with an Indian project? How would one party become aware of the other? When it comes to staff, the first priority is education. The great changes we experience and expect to face in the future, the more important is the education of the people. Education, as opposed to training, I should say, develops the whole purpose. It goes beyond training because the focus is upon building maturity, responsibility, integrity, and leadership qualities. I include travel in education when it serves to broaden a person's awareness and to increase their preparedness for more responsibility. Indeed, you could say people at this conference right now are undergoing education. In the example of the Indian project I gave before, the way people were placed tells the story. A generation ago, our officers in India were invariably British, mainly Scottish. Today, only 7 of the 250 people occupying senior posts in our Indian operation are expatriate staff. And they come from all parts of the world. They come from Japan, France, Sri Lanka, Spain, Australia, and of course, Scotland. Yet an Indian expatriate runs our Taiwan office. The region is becoming far more cosmopolitan, and the calibre of our people is raised through this policy. One problem we face has been the acceptance by governments of the need for expatriate staff. Even expatriate staff placed where they are to improve their knowledge or their education of a region. We want our head office people to get first-hand line management experience in the region, to bring techniques from the head office to outlying areas of our operation, and we need them to return, or others to come from those areas with their abilities, their knowledge, their skills of that particular area. Business understands this need of moving people to expand the knowledge of the total enterprise. But unfortunately, some governments have yet to appreciate that this process is good for their nation as well as for an international enterprise. There are many other problems, but this problem brings me to an opportunity. The opportunity to develop the region. As people live and work in positions away from their home, they begin to make deeper personal contacts with people in their host country. A young Australian banker might have close friends in Singapore, Hong Kong, or Thailand. He or she will perhaps become an insider of a different culture. I use the term insider in the strategist sense, as someone who is no longer seen by his host as a foreigner, not the practice, of course, of insider trading. Let it put me another way. As good staff become members of the community of different countries in this region, they become known personally. People of the region see each other face to face. Here is the fundamental relationship of banking, and probably of most other businesses: personal contact. It can be sustained by technology and airlines, but only after the first contact is made on the personal level does it work. Literally, the human face must be seen and heard. From another aspect, we can reflect on the many ongoing opportunities which friendships and understandings allow, flowing from alumni associations, the non-quantifiable but undoubted value which accrues from university days together. I believe that the opportunity to improve the quality of personal contacts is great. This conference affords such an opportunity to progress contacts. Commerce is one of the most peaceful means of developing worthwhile, lasting links. And at the same time, it develops networks for the region. One slogan puts it, think global, act local. It means putting people first, for it is in people that all our values and aspirations are found. That is the challenge I share with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Will Bailey. Our next speaker this afternoon is Mr. Tomohiro Ishiguro from the Bank of Tokyo. But before I introduce Mr. Ishiguro, Mr. Bailey has another pressing commitment this afternoon, which will require him to leave before the end of our scheduled ending for this session. So we've decided, particularly in view of the discussion this morning about the responsibility of banks for third world debt, to make a change in the program. We will now have Mr. Ishiguro, but following Mr. Ishiguro's presentation, we will have the forum discussion on banking and finance, which will probably go for 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll adjourn for afternoon tea and have the remainder of the program after the afternoon tea break. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Mr. Tomohiro Ishiguro, who is the Director and General Manager of the Bank of Tokyo Australia Limited in Melbourne. And the Bank of Tokyo Australia, of course, is a 100% subsidiary of the Bank of Tokyo Limited in Japan. Mr. Ishiguro joined the Bank of Tokyo in 1963, and during his career in the bank he has predominantly worked in the international finance area. He's had overseas postings elsewhere, and particularly in London, but I think important from the point of view of this gathering, he has also had a period of secondment to the Asian Development Bank in Manila. Now, we all know that the Bank of Tokyo is the international flagship of Japanese banking. I hope there are no other of my Japanese friends here today to hear me say that, but I think it is reasonably accepted that the Bank of Tokyo is the international flagship, and the Bank of Tokyo's representation here is just another example of the kind of interchange which must increasingly take place throughout the world. Now, I was particularly impressed this morning when one of the speakers said that we should feel privileged as Australians that this conference takes place in the English language, and perhaps the fact that it does is an indication of the dedication of our Asian friends to the success of Asian cooperation. And as another example of that, Mr. Ishiguro is known to his friends here as Tom. So, Tom, I ask you to address us.
Chairman, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much for kind introduction, Mr. White. I'm seldom called Mr. Ishiguro here. Mr. White said, I'm called Tom, and it's very hard to react when I called Mr. Ishiguro. Perhaps I'm too much Australian, and I don't know whether I deserve to speak something as a Japanese here. Anyway, according to the program of this Congress, I'm supposed to perform the role of an Asian partner to Mr. Bailey in the banking sector. However, I was also told that my address did not to be confined to banking. I should feel free to talk about anything so long as it relates to human development. Today, I would talk something else, not the banking, and I wish to talk about my own, I repeat, my own observation on what the word internationalization means to Japanese. Itself a developing country only 100-odd years ago, Japan has achieved its modernization and industrialization. Especially in the last 20 to 30 years, Japanese companies, especially trading houses, banks, other financing institutions and manufacturers, as well as government and governmental agencies, have established their offices and operations all over the world. Of course, you're well aware of the existence of Japanese firms and business persons overseas. Also, individuals are represented as tourists. These days, Japanese are virtually everywhere. Is this phenomenon a proof that the Japanese have been truly internationalized? In 2,000 years of Japanese history, the real effort to modernize Japan started only 120 years ago, after maintaining 300 years of seclusion by the Tokugawa shogunate. With the coming of Meiji Restoration in 1868, Japan started to import indiscriminately virtually everything possible from for its modernization: politics, economics, monetary system, education, medicine, as well as industrial technology and engineering, all from the West. Before the Tokugawa shogunate, we did have contacts with and stimulated by overseas people such as Portuguese, Chinese, and Koreans, however, on a limited scale. Therefore, for the Japanese, the word internationalization has been synonymous with the westernization, or to catch up with the Western civilization. We Japanese formed our own beliefs and philosophy from traditions handed down by our ancestors over thousands of years. We always succeeded in digesting those Western concepts, science and technology, and blended them harmoniously into traditional social structure. The process was